The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ancient Warfare Magazine podcast. In this episode, we're looking at Volume 11, Issue 6, Victory for Sparta, the finale of the Peloponnesian War. So joining me tonight is Jasper Otage, Lindsay Powell, Mark McCaffrey and Mark DeSantis. So Jasper, we're looking at the final phase of the Peloponnesian War. Can you bring us up to speed with the story so far?
The story so far is that after the first phase of the Peloponnesian War, you get the Peace of Kalias, and then Athens gets in its head that it wants to mess around in Sicily. That's a whole separate story. It's a long and complicated campaign. It is not designed to get Sparta back into the war, but effectively it does. And they just sort of stumble back into war. And the rest of the Peloponnesian War is a long, drawn-out, complicated story, really, of how it's for an ancient, you know, ancient military history, campaigns and wars are generally fairly simple, with armies go here, armies go there. They have a battle. There's an outcome. There may be a few more, but then you have a decisive position. This war, the end of this war, it's a complicated story of smaller and larger campaigns. The influence of Persia, giving money, giving support. There's internal Persian politicking going on. There's a lot of complicated politics going on in Athens itself, and almost who's going to win the war seems to change year by year, and in the end it is Sparta, really. And then you could argue that the Peloponnesian War ends in 404, but the story is still not done. But that's for another episode again.
We're coming in at the end of Sicily, aren't we? Who has the upper hand at that point?
Well, the upper hand at the end of the Sicilian campaign is held by Sparta. Athens has seen its fleet wrecked. It's poured massive amounts of treasure down the drain, trying to capture Syracuse. The perceived weakness of Athens, it's lost thousands and thousands of men, hoplites and rowers. The perceived weakness of Athens, 413 onward, is really, I think, what helps to kill Athens in the end, in that it, even though Athens had a lot of life left and it was able to revive its fortunes over the years, it's what made Sparta look think that it could actually defeat Athens again and build a large battle fleet to go after the Aegean Black Sea lifeline through which Athens imported the great majority of its food.
This may, maybe good before you go on, Mark, to emphasize, if you really boil it down to a very great big simplification, is that Athens just basically in pure territory in the Greek mainland holds only a very small part, and it's that territory is not big enough to supply food supply for its entire population. In the first phase of the Peloponnesian War, the Spartans constantly, the Peloponnesian armies, you should say, really, the alliance comes in, they destroy some stuff, and they leave again, which usually gives at least the Athenians some time to raise some crops there, but most of their food supply comes from elsewhere in their empire, and mostly from the Black Sea area.
Well, that can be said for all of Greece, really. I mean, on the one hand, Athens is coming from the Black Sea, but on the other hand, you've got Sparta and its Peloponnesian allies drawing food from maybe the Western channels as such. So in terms of the defeat of Athens, the victory for the Syracusans, that's actually playing into the hands of the Spartans and the Peloponnesians in terms of their food supply.
That's true. The big change in the second phase of the war is that it's also called the Thessalian War, is Sparta occupies a small village in Attica and thereby blocks the use of most of the land territory of Athens. It makes it much harder for Athens to use the silver from the Laurian mines, get that into Athens to pay for its armies.
It's Alcibiades who suggests this, isn't it? Who's defected from Athens.
Yes.
So why has nobody thought to do this earlier? Because it seems like a really obvious thing to do. It's kind of a war. It changes war from being a direct confrontation.
I think it's more a matter of convincing the Spartans to actually go for this policy. I don't think it's something that wouldn't have occurred to them before this, but actually convincing the vast majority of the Gerousia, the ephors and whatnot in Sparta that this will be something that they can carry through and is worthwhile in terms of a permanent garrison that's going to be permanently stationed there. I mean, the Spartans are notorious for not wanting to, overexert themselves too far away from home and whatnot.
Spartan war making was also hindered very greatly by the capture of a few hundred Spartan citizen hoplites at Sphacteria in 425 BC. So what happened was is that for several years leading up to the Peace of Nicias, they were too afraid to, I think, really prosecute the war effectively. And there was something about the way that the Spartans conducted themselves that was, they were afraid to win. And mainly because they didn't want to lose their citizens. There was only once their citizens returned to them as part of the peace that they started to look to do something differently. That being said, it took them a very long time to not merely fortify a position in Attica, Decalia, but it took them until after the Athenians looked vulnerable at sea to actually go after that Black Sea lifeline, food lifeline, which could only be done with a powerful navy of their own. So it was in 413 that the Spartans finally got around to funding a big fleet among the Peloponnesians. They had 100 ships built, and that's when they also obtained funding from the Persians, and they started basing their fleet on the other side of the Aegean. Though the policy that the Spartans were now taking the fight to the Athenians at sea in the Aegean. But the backing of the Persians in the first few years of this new Ionian War, if you want to call it the Ionian War, which is sometimes also known as the Decalian War, this Persian support was half-hearted. It would seem that Tissaphernes, who is the satrap of Lydia, he was playing a double game with both the Athenians and the Spartans. That is, he mainly supported the Spartans, but never enough, never to the point where the Spartans could deliver a knockout blow against the Athenians. The Athenians are also still had the best navy in the best navy, and they were able to regain their footing in a series of very big naval battles over the years 411 and 410. What changed for the Spartans, and I'm using them to cover the Peloponnesians too, is that a number of things. First, they had a navarch come in, an admiral of the entire fleet, Lysander, who instilled a sense of discipline and real operational control to the fleet that was, even if the typical, Peloponnesian rower wasn't as good as a Athenian rower, at the level of an entire fleet, they turned out to be as good with him as admiral. But also, it was the appearance of Prince Cyrus the Younger, who took over for Tissaphernes as the commander, the warlord of for the Persians in the in Western Asia. Cyrus was much more open-handed with his with Persian gold, and managed to finance the Peloponnesian fleet to the extent that, even though the Athenians were drubbing the Peloponnesians pretty regularly, and they had smacked the Peloponnesian fleet badly at Arginusae, the Peloponnesians were able to just rebuild the fleets with Persian gold and Persian timber.
What's funny about this is it seems very flippant when we talk about, and the magazine sort of reflects, and they rebuilt their fleet. Surely this must have been war in slow motion. You don't just rebuild a fleet of, 50-100 ships. It must take months, if not years.
It takes 60 days to build one of these ships. We know that from Livy tells us about the building of the Roman fleet during the Punic Wars.
Is that from the trees coming down, or is that, provided you've got the timber ready to rock and roll?
That's from the wood being felled to them getting in the water. But the only problem is you're not taking into account training crews then.
You might suspect that it would be months or years to rebuild these ships, but these were not Royal Navy ships of the line from the Napoleonic Wars.
Which actually could be built at great speed too.
Yes, but the triremes themselves, I believe, if the model of what was done during the Punic Wars holds, and I think it does, is that most of these ships were built according to a very standardized plan. That is, the parts were produced in a roughly industrial scale, where you could have the timber shaped and put into a ship, whichever ship was going up, and they were more or less interchangeable. So, and once all of these parts were cut and shaped, they could be assembled relatively quickly. Now, how long would it have taken the Peloponnesians to have rebuilt a fleet, considering that they had access to Persian money and Persian trees? I'm not certain, but it could be done. So, for example, the Peloponnesians had lost badly at Arginusae in 406, but at Aegospotami in 405, they had an entirely rebuilt battle fleet. So it would seem that these fleets could be assembled, put together fairly quickly.
You're also assuming that they're building all of these. I mean, in terms of, Aegospotami, that you've got the Spartans actually capturing Athenian ships and adding them to their fleet. You've got earlier in the early days of the Delian League, you've got the Athenians seizing ships from other so-called allies. A certain number of the ships could be just acquired from allies or acquired from enemies and whatnot.
While it certainly does seem that there was no fundamental design difference between, there was not as much of a design difference between Athenian triremes and Peloponnesian triremes. If you just look at the basic structure of the ship, and that you could probably have captured one and used it yourself, I'm not certain how often that happened, because while I'm sure it did happen, the triremes were all subject to deterioration over time from just simply being in the water, from use. So a captured ship, especially if it had been damaged, might not have been as useful to the capturing power as you might suspect. There was one major difference in ships that it seems that the Peloponnesians developed as opposed to and used maybe, is that Athenian vessels were built for maneuvering. That is, they were fast, deliver a ramming attack, and backwater, retreat, and ram again. At least in the great harbor of Syracuse, they would strengthen the prows of their ships, the Syracusans, and it presumably the techniques of having stronger prows going straight ahead and ramming prow to prow would have been used by the Peloponnesians too as a means of combating the more skilled rowers of the Athenian fleets.
There's a couple things. A few people I know have tried to study how long ships stay useful, and it's very difficult to estimate that, but it seems like somewhere between 10 and 20 years is valid. So from 1 year to the next, that would not be a problem probably for most ships.
Well, it depends on maintenance as well.
The so-called, you know, they would just sort of classify them as fast triremes, which were triremes, which were not waterlogged or hardly waterlogged and didn't have very much growth on them, and ships which had been used for a longer time, but that doesn't seem to be a problem. And I think the point with all the reconstituted fleets to remember also is that probably, I mean, we don't really know, but most of these you know, a disabled trireme probably would not sink. It would probably just sit deeper in the water and just be disabled. And with a little luck, if people weren't too aggressive, the rowers would survive. And this is where all that money comes in. It seems that rowers were convinced to change sides, you know, when it came to the victor side.
Mercenary by nature.
Yeah, or just they just might come back if somebody else suddenly had a lot more money, because there's descriptions that they just go wherever the money is.
There's a suggestion as well that after the losses that Athens has suffered in Sicily, that many of their, you know, potential rowers will start to, you know, naturally migrate towards the Persian or the Spartan fleets, you know, looking, you know, thinking they're a better bet for the, you know, future employment.
That said, it's clearly that, I mean, I don't know how long we should theorize about how this was done, but clearly there were enormous efforts to build these fleets anew time and again, because it is amazing. But it happens later on too. The Romans do it too. If you look at Octavian's campaigns against Sextus Pompeius, it's like, they're just he launches his ships against the other Romans in Sicily, and a storm comes by, and that was the fleet gone. Next year, entirely new fleet with dozens of ships. It just, I guess, if you just get enough people together, and you put them all to work.
There's a conversation preserved in Xenophon in which Prince Cyrus asks Lysander, so presumably dates to sometime around 407 BC, you know, what can I do to make you happy? And Lysander says, you know, you can raise the pay rate for a rower in my fleet from 3 obols, that's half a drachma a day, to 4 obols. And that would have been a better rate than what the Athenians were paying. Okay, because by the end of the Peloponnesian War, I guess being cash strapped, they had to reduce their pay rates to, that seems to have encouraged many of these rowers to migrate from the Athenian fleet to the Peloponnesian fleet. So what would happen is that, you know, when we see these fleets and we say, oh, well, you know, there were 200 crew aboard a trireme, whether an Athenian or a Peloponnesian, and you say, well, they had 100, you know, triremes. Well, that means 20,000 rowers and sailors and hoplites. Probably many of these triremes, especially in the later years when cash was hard to come by and the wars were not going well, probably many of these triremes were operating with less than a full crew. That is, fewer than the 170 rowers, which would have been the full complement of rowers. I have a feeling that the advantage that the Peloponnesians may have had later on could have simply been is that if you have more rowers available, your ships are faster. You have, you can maneuver better. Money did have a important effect towards the end, because constantly, Xenophon, Plutarch, they will say that, how do you fight an enemy whose paymaster is the great king of Persia? And that was the ultimately that's the thing that made the difference for the Peloponnesians, for the Spartans. That is, they had an unlimited supply of money with which to build ships, pay rowers. Even if they lost them, they could replace them.
Well, here's a question for you. We've alluded to it before. You know, why are the Persians supporting the Spartans against Athens? Why?
They're supporting them because they're supporting both, or to start with, both Athens and Sparta. Periodically, they've decided that after the Persian Wars, the invasions of Darius and Xerxes, and the defeats at Marathon and Salamis and whatnot, that it's a better bet to actually defeat the Greeks by pushing them against each other rather than actually spending your time taking an army and navy against them yourself. So they're basically grinding them into the ground, hoping that they can then capitalize it on the whole situation later on.
The Persians also wanted to regain the ability to collect tribute from the Greek cities of Ionia and Western Asia Minor. After the defeats that the Persians had suffered against the Athenian-led Delian League, the Persians were denied the ability to collect that money. And once the Athenians looked mortal after the disaster at Syracuse in 413, various satraps came forward to Sparta to attempt to interest them in plans to hit the Athenians in the Aegean region. One of those satraps was Tissaphernes, the satrap of Lydia. But he had never been very enthusiastic about funding the Spartans to the point where they could deal a knockout blow against the Athenians for various reasons. It's when the Spartans managed to link up with the satrap of the Hellespontine region, that was Pharnabazus, and concentrate their forces against the link to the Black Sea, which is once again where Athens' food's coming from, that Athens' strategic position started to deteriorate much more rapidly. And the Persians wanted to regain control of the western fringe of their empire.
Call me a skeptic in all of this, but I just find that this whole history of from Sicily onwards, you start to get a history that's dominated by individuals. And I don't know if it's that we can trust the sources that we've got, that we can trust Thucydides, and what we get from Plutarch later on and whatnot, to actually say, well, was it that these guys are, so influential? Or is it a feature of the historiography of this period that we just get, the influence of individuals is overdone? Saying that the Spartans are helping the Syracusans by sending one man, Gylippus, saying that Alcibiades is so influential that he's, influencing Spartan policy and then going over to the Persians and convincing Tissaphernes that might be a good idea to bankroll the Athenians and the Spartans at the same time. It just all seems to be a little bit dramatic, the whole thing. Are we sort of overplaying the whole individual is so influential, or
It could very well be. Hard to figure out if it's the case, though.
Well, surely there must be a level of practicality. You know, the distances it would take involved, you know, these people would have to be everywhere all at once making decisions and moving things backwards and forwards. All right, things did move about faster than one might have thought, but still.
I do think the credit that Thucydides gives to Alcibiades for convincing Tissaphernes to essentially play the Spartans off the Athenians and the Athenians off the Spartans and have them fight each other. I think it can be a bit overdone in the sense that Tissaphernes was an extremely capable, intelligent, subtle man. He could very well have seen that he had more to gain by keeping Sparta and Athens fighting and damaging themselves, and that would have been better for Persia. It certainly seems that no matter what promises he had made to the Spartans, that the Spartan naval strategy to take the war to Athens and the Aegean got nowhere while they had to rely upon Tissaphernes' backing. So it may very well be that whatever advice Alcibiades gave to Tissaphernes is something that just Tissaphernes himself would have agreed with and wanted to put into effect, as a matter of course. I think, though, that when it comes to the individuals elsewhere in this story, I think that Lysander was a notable, important figure in all of this, because Lysander was able to take hold of the Peloponnesian fleet, which had been improving, but he because he kept it so tightly under control, he got around whatever superiority the Athenians may have had in terms of experience, in terms of superior rowing ability, in terms of just, the numbers of people who may have had more knowledge about how to command ships. He was able to, at the level of an entire battle fleet, make his superior to that of Athens. And it was a superiority that manifested itself, for example, at Aegospotami, in a remarkable way. It didn't have really anything to do with nautical fighting. It was
that's the decisive closing battle of the war, isn't it?
Yes,
that was the decisive battle, which was not as much of a battle itself in 405 BC. That is, the Athenians constantly cast-strapped and not especially well disciplined. The Athenian rowers would get off their ships when they had beached them and have to go far afield to go find food. And what Lysander did was is that he kept his men close to their ships. They were never far away. He determined that the Athenians were not ready for battle, and he got his rowers aboard, sortied. And by the time that the Athenians realized what was happening, it was too late. The Athenian fleet, the last Athenian fleet, was largely destroyed right there on the beach.
But this is, again, being played up to the point of, looking at the individual of Alcibiades and saying, this is his last key moment trying to influence Athens, coming down to the Athenian generals and saying, don't you see what is going on here? He's going to be pulling this stunt on you. And of course, at this point, Alcibiades has done his dash with the Athenian generals, and they know what, that they're playing with fire. If they listen to him, what they'll get it in the neck when they go home because of what's happened to Alcibiades, at that point, the most recent swing of general opinion has gone against him. So they basically say, no, we're not listening to you, go away. And, of course, it's all sort of used to play up, here's Alcibiades' last swing of the dice, it doesn't work, so off he goes into, semi-retirement as such until he gets assassinated later on. But, yeah.
So you're saying our sources are playing, who are the big sources? It's Thucydides, Xenophon, and
Plutarch.
So do you think they're building it up, building up the personalities to rev up the narrative to give us a better story?
I think they're focusing on individual stories more than more than the big picture. You know, there's some smaller players that come into it that, you know, don't get as much of a run. But actually, then when you sort of look at it, you sort of say, hold on, they've been in the background the whole time. They're being put in charge of fleets. You know, what's going on? We haven't heard. They're not the one our sources are interested in.
Well, Alcibiades is an arch villain, isn't he? He makes a wonderful anti-hero or hero, depending on, you know, where he figures in the story. And every good book needs one or both. So I think your philosophy is probably on the mark.
Yeah, it's a good narrative a narrative plot device as well, isn't it? As you said, to drive things forward.
Well, especially if you consider how complicated this, as I said in the beginning, it's a more complicated story over those 10 years, with several players at the national level, plus all those political developments in Athens itself. Using people to keep track of it is much easier than going, and then this development, and then that. And
I think there's another subtext here, which is it's the struggle with the democracy against something of a, I guess it would be a monarchy. So it's the culture of the amateur, and the ease in which the amateur can be upended because they're not professional, and the mob can also be swayed to follow one guy or the other, and. In a sense that it's a moral tale as well, and depending on which side you take, it's a good or a bad outcome.
But our historians are actually using the individuals to, you know, tell that tale. I mean, they personify the different factions. I mean, if you go back earlier in the war, it's Cleon that you know going out there. You know, you've got Pericles giving these great speeches and whatnot. Each of these individuals is representative of a group in the political subtext.
Yeah, it's interesting. You could almost, in a sense, imagine Thucydides' history as a sort of Greek tragedy, a multi-episode one, and he's the chorus effect. He comes in every so often and makes these observations. And these masked characters with, you know, their somewhat stereotypical look, as you say, you learn the story through their actions and inactions sometimes.
And then, of course, Thucydides himself is a character too.
So, I mean, we call it the Peloponnesian War, which is never used by Thucydides. This shows some sort of modern bias.
I think that it depends if you were a splitter or a lumper. That is, if you want to just say, well, the identity of the major combatants, Athens and Sparta, were the same in both conflicts, and just call it one big war, and say that the peace that they had, the Peace of Nicias, was a false peace, or at the very least a cold peace. It didn't last very long. You're entitled, as Thucydides did, to call it, you know, one war, the Peloponnesian War. I think also, though, you can make a very strong case for considering them two separate wars, because there was at least a significant chunk of time where the Athenians and Spartans were not in direct conflict. The Athenians were able to take a few years off to go and fight a gigantic war in Sicily.
Even that doesn't actually break it up. There's still conflict going on in Greece during that period. It's just a realignment of factions.
And what I would say is that, you know, you could make the argument following on from that, if you were a splitter, okay, the Archidamian War was won largely by Athens, and they effectively encircled the Peloponnesus with naval bases. They raided it well. They captured the Spartan citizen hoplites and were able to strangle the Spartans enough to have them come to terms. But with the disaster in Syracuse in 413, Athens now looked vulnerable. It encouraged the Spartans to come out again for a rematch. And so you have the Decelean or Ionian War, where at least the theater of the war, to my mind, changed greatly. That is, the Ionian War, which I think is a very good term for it, really was a naval war, with the focus being the Aegean and the Hellespont away from mainland Greece. I think both answers are right. It was one war. It was two wars. It all depends on what your going to categorize.
Is there a third category? I'm going to sort of say, in effect, you could actually give it an overarching title of the Greek World War. In the same way that we refer to the Second World War, which in fact is itself like that one you've described, it's in different theaters. And in order to make sense of it, you sort of lump all these things together. There's a political dimension, there's a military dimension, and just the individual stories only make sense within the context of the whole. So by calling it Peloponnesian War, you don't really get that sense.
Besides, by calling it the Peloponnesian War, it's the same way as the Brits talking about the Dutch Wars, or, it's from the point of view of Athens, where we were at war with the Peloponnesians. The Peloponnesians might have called it the Athenian War or the Delian League War. You could also argue that it is... It's kind of, it's just, we just put it together, as Mark said, it's multiple wars and we just stick them together because it's in one book of Thucydides. Well, it's eight, but it's in one narrative of Thucydides, or you could say it's all part of an ongoing competition, really, for the hegemony in Greece between Athens and Sparta that lasts from the Persian Wars all the way into the 4th century.
You've got all of that stuff that leading up to it back in the 450s as well. So you could sort of extend it all the way back there and say that's where it really starts.
Are there any other sources from other cultures? I'm thinking, for example, from Persia, from Egypt, that we get some kind of other perspective, how they see it, looking on the outside in?
There might be some. But just like, as we know, we terribly little about the Persian side of the Greco-Persian Wars.
That was interesting because you can imagine that it's a world which does have diplomatic relationships and they have people monitoring these things because I think you described earlier, they're looking at opportunity to go in and break alliances and cause disruption to achieve a longer term goal, which is to their benefit, of course.
I don't think we know is the problem.
In reference to that, Rudolph from Facebook asks, to what degree did the outcome of the Peloponnesian War match with the Persian political goals regarding the Greek city-states?
Well, interestingly enough, here's I think, a very interesting rationale for Prince Cyrus's relatively sudden decision or to back the Peloponnesians much more strongly when he became the warlord of the territories of Western Asia. The idea is that Cyrus, he was just 17 when he became the overseer of these territories, and he knew eventually that he would one day have to fight a civil war against his older brother for the throne. And the idea is that he would want Greek soldiers on his side. He wanted to hire them to fight for him in the civil war that he knew was coming eventually. And that the only way that these Greek soldiers were going to be available in sufficient numbers would be if the war in Greece was ended and they were suddenly unemployed and needed to be hired on by himself. And so according to this theory, what you see is that Cyrus comes in and funds the Peloponnesians. He also becomes very friendly with Lysander at this time. The Peloponnesians, in relatively short order, are able to gain the upper hand over the Athenians, even though they do lose at Arginusae. But what happens is that the fleet then gets rebuilt very quickly. And eventually, once the war ends in 400, you see that Cyrus is indeed marching inland with thousands of Greek mercenaries at his side to fight the civil war against his brother. So which the Battle of Kunaxa goes badly for him. He does not win. But that's the one theory about, like, did these Persian goals match? It matched Cyrus's goals.
Athens is eventually surrounded. It's forced to capitulate. To what degree did the Spartan victory, was it a result of the subsidies from Persia, do we think?
I think it was almost entirely due to Persian subsidies. It was Persian gold that allowed them to rebuild their fleets after their defeat at Arginusae. I think that the Athenians understood that too. There's a relatively little known speech given by an Athenian orator named Andocides, who in 392, in the middle of another war, he made reference to how the Athenians had decided to support the rebellion of Amorges, who was a rebellious Persian subject in the coast of Asia Minor in Caria, and that the Athenians, because of their arrogance, supported his rebellion and managed to upset the great king so much that was eventually what caused the great king to come in and finance the Spartans to a much greater degree than they had during the Archidamian War. And I think that it was that combination of, so the Athenians obviously saw Persian money as the crucial factor. Just about all of the historians see Persian money as being an immensely important factor. And you can imagine that the advantage of having a nearly unlimited supply of money with which to pay your rowers and rebuild your ships was an enormous advantage to the Spartans.
So what were the long-term results of the war?
Well, I'm going to throw this in. If you take a very long view here, it sounds like, in effect, it was a proxy war that the Persians wanted to see played out. So in other words, the Athenians take the casualties and the Spartans actually win it. But in effect, what they've done is actually weakened this sort of Greek world in readiness for Alexander the Great to emerge, who ultimately throws over the Persian Empire. So if you take the very long view, it was frankly a failure from the Persian side. And of course, Athens becomes somewhat of a backwater, relatively speaking, and ultimately Sparta becomes even more of a backwater, becomes even less relevant in the emerging world.
It's been argued, certainly, that the Spartan victory was not very much help, not very helpful for Sparta, because it caused them political turmoil. It's been referenced already that they'd lost. During the war, they'd lost a substantial number of their already limited number of full citizens, and that trend is not changing into the fourth century. In fact, it's getting worse. A part of that is just it's casualties. A part of that is richer Spartans buying farms of poorer citizens who cannot afford to. Who cannot afford their contributions to their mess, and therefore are not considered full citizens anymore. That kind of in the Greek world, I think that, or generally maybe in ancient history, that kind of exclusive policies to keep the citizenry limited is. In the long term, never seems to work. And conversely, well, we've discussed that before. When the Romans, one reason the Romans may have been so successful is that they are not as exclusive, and they just expand their citizen base and their tax base constantly, and are able to have new armies all the time. And well, that's a whole different discussion.
I have one really counterfactual sort of question to sort of finish with from one of our patrons, from Chris. Thank you very much, Chris. Would Athens have won the war without the disaster in Sicily in 413?
Thucydides says keep to, you know, defensive war, keep to, you know, don't spread yourself out too far, and keep to your finances and whatnot, following Thucydides' advice. Thucydides speaking through the voice of Pericles there, sorry. In terms of following that advice, it makes it sound really, you know, good advice. But on the other hand, if Athens would have won that that conflict in Sicily, then Athens, you know, might have gone much further. On the other hand, would the Persians have come in anyway? We don't know.
I think at root that the problem of the Athenians during the entire war was hubris. That is, Pericles had cautioned them from the very beginning of the war not to engage in the more rash attempts on distant powers. That is, there had been talk even during Pericles' day of trying to conquer Sicily, trying to conquer maybe Egypt or Italy or even Carthage. And he was counseling them to not engage in such grandiose projects, to husband your forces, weather the storm from the Peloponnesus, which is what they did in the Archidamian War. That is, they did restrain themselves enough and stick to their naval strategy that the Archidamian War largely ended in an Athenian victory. I think that Athenian hubris, though, was never more evident when, having recovered somewhat from the ravages of the plague and the damages that they'd sustained during the war, that they attempted this completely unnecessary attack on Sicily, which went nowhere and destroyed hundreds of ships and lost them thousands of lives. And then even after they had recovered from the disaster in Sicily and had restored their strategic position during the Ionian War in the Aegean, which it was that Black Sea lifeline which was all important that they had to protect, they spurned making peace when they had the chance. That is, after the Battle of Cyzicus, the in 410, the Spartans made they made a plea for peace. And the Athenians rejected it, and it ended up that by continuing the war, they just gave the...
Both sides gave up that opportunity for peace numbers of times. I mean...
I agree. The Spartans spurned peace too, but that was mainly in the Archidamian War, whereas had the Athenians just had some sort of negotiated peace in maybe around 410 or something like that, you would not have given the Persians time to come in and fund the Peloponnesian fleet. You would not have found Lysander. The Peloponnesian Navy would never have become so capable. And you could have said at least that the Athenians had won. Would war have broken out subsequently for some other reason? Would we be talking about maybe a third element of war between the Athenians and the Spartans? You know, quite possibly, but at least the Athenians would have had the chance to catch their breath.
Well, it struck me, I made some analogy and I wrote it down, but I can't find it now, about them being sort of like two punch drunk boxers. Neither wanted to stop, so it's almost didn't matter who didn't win. It needed something ultimately absolutely decisive at the end to bring it to a finish.
I think it's interesting that you've, at the end of the Peloponnesian War, we see a break. Greece goes into a different mode of war immediately afterwards. You know, you've got the next two powers that really come to, you know, you've got the rise of smaller but, you know, more significant powers of Argos or Corinth or Thebes eventually, but it's all land-based war in the coming decades. It's a sort of a move away from the great fleets that have been really, you know, slugging it out throughout. And whether this is that they've just exhausted the naval resources of Greece and that they have to turn to another, you know, another theatre of war, or whether it's, you know, an attitude that's changed. I'm not sure.
Or money,
yeah. It's cheaper to get out of land force.
Yeah, naval warfare has traditionally been throughout history generally been much more expensive than.
On the other hand, it also moves you away from the Persians. You know, whether the, you know, it's an attitude in Greece of saying, well, you know, if we get into that again, then we're, you know, going to involve Persians again. You know, that's where our money for fleets come from. So therefore, you know, in order to be, you know, more Hellenic based.
Well, you could argue also, in a sense, I mean, if these were the super weapons of their day, and both sides were able to use them, I mean, in fact, advantage was net lost. So you spend all that money for a competitive advantage, which actually proves to be worthless. You may as well go back to the old style, and you know, you're taking basically citizen armies. You know, people just grab their shield and their armor, and off they go to fight. And last man standing wins. I mean, that was the old way of fighting.
It's interesting, though, that in the 4th century, you also get at least attempts at innovation for land warfare. So maybe there was an idea that there was something to be won there. Yeah, could be.
Sparta itself was, I think, a reluctant naval power. That is, it was, they would much rather have fought every battle on land if they could have. That was what their strength was. The decision to go and challenge the Athenians at sea was never something that they were eager to do. And when I think that they had the opportunity to, you know, go back to fighting as a land power, I think that that's where their heart was. I think that's what they saw. There was no need to maybe, you know, build that giant battle fleet to take on the Athenians afterward. The Athenian navy in the 4th century was not nearly as well-funded and powerful as it was in the 5th century, because the tribute system had broken down to a shadow of what it once was. I think that there's significant differences there in how the wars of the 4th century would have been fought. But the Spartans themselves, they finally put together a fleet that was able to defeat the Athenians ultimately. And that was the difference. That made the difference in the Ionian War.
It's interesting that also, you know, Thucydides starts out his narrative of the whole entire war focusing on, you know, the estimated naval powers, you know, naval capabilities of, you know, Corcyra or Corinth, and, you know, talking about their naval power and what they can bring to the table. Even, you know, talking about that Aegina had been, you know, temporarily a player in there to start with, rivaling Athens. And it's all that emphasis of naval power is where the future is going. That's the narrative at the start of his whole, you know, history. And then, you know, now we're talking, you know, by the end of it, you know, by the end of the war, naval power seems to have run its course.
I think for Athens, naval power was what kept the link to the Black Sea in under their control. That is, with the long walls extending from Athens to Piraeus, Athens was effectively an island nation, and that as long as it could import its food, because Attica just couldn't, you know, feed the population on its produce alone. As long as it could control the routes to the Black Sea and the wheat that came from the Black Sea, Athens was effectively invulnerable. So the Achilles heel, if you want to call it, or the Clausewitz would say the center of gravity of the Athenian Empire was the Black Sea, and so the navy was what shielded that. As soon as the Athenian navy was overcome, Athens itself was extremely vulnerable, and that's why the war ended within a few months of Aegisthotomy.
Well, they were running a racket, basically, too, weren't they? I mean, basically, you know, protection money, you know, the fleet stays in your harbour. If you don't pay the protection money, hey, suffer the consequences. I mean, you can't run an empire on that basis for very long, because you're not loved. I mean, putting it in very simple terms. Why would you carry on with the subterfuge? So I'm sure there were lots of people in the Mediterranean, the Aegean Islands, all the way up the coast, who were thrilled to see that collapse.
Also, the idea of, you know, you mentioned empire, that, you know, the thirst for empire changes at the end of the war in terms of the what system of government Athens is, you know, going through. They drop the more radical democracy. They go to, you know, through their experiment of oligarchy and whatnot, You know, there's not the direction that they had at the start of the war as well, in terms of we are, you know, we're going to develop our empire.
Yeah. I forget which, is it Miletus? So which is the island where the Athenians commit such atrocities? Okay. And when the news gets back, it's that interesting sense of realization. What have we become? You know, we were prepared to do all of this, and look what we've become. And so, in a sense, we go back to this idea of the moral of the story is, you know, in a sense, democracies are great, but when people forget their moral code, it can be a terrible way to run the world.
Well, there's a conclusion.
Shall we? Shall we call that a day? I'm not sure what we're discussing next time. Jasper suggested, why are we fascinated by ancient warfare? But if you have a topic for us, why not let us know? And you can find us at patreon.com/ancientwarfarepodcast. So thank you, Jasper, Lindsay, Mark and Mark. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.